From 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect Weekend. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. Today on the show, a look at some of the many developments transforming Milwaukee's central city, including the Milwaukee Symphony Orchestra's plans for the Warner Grand Theater Complex.
To get that being reused, redeveloped, is really a big step forward for West Wisconsin Avenue in general. You combine that with what's happening with the Avenue, what we used to call Grand Avenue Mall, and that's finally starting to bring West Wisconsin Avenue up to the level that much of the rest of downtown has been in the last few years.
Then the profound effect that turning an oral history of basketball into a book had on one writer.
Being able to look at what feels like a version of the Dead Sea Scrolls of basketball, all this accumulated wisdom from generations of men and women, young and old, who played the game, it's powerful stuff to see those raw words on the page.
And we'll have the latest in our storytelling series, Exfabula. Lake Effect Weekend is next, after the news. Good afternoon. This is Lake Effect Weekend on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Bonnie North. From the opening of the Fiserv Forum to the Milwaukee streetcar, 2018 was a year of major changes for the central city. But 2019 may prove to be even more transformative for downtown Milwaukee.
There are several ongoing projects that will dramatically alter Milwaukee's skyline. Some will rejuvenate areas that are currently marred by vacant buildings. Others will impact public transit, the city's lakefront, and some of our most cherished institutions.
Tom Dakin is a reporter who covers commercial real estate and development for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. He spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers and starts by explaining the project to remodel the Grand Avenue Mall.
What's happening there is basically no more mall. It's been dying for years anyway. The current owners, which is a group led by Tony Janowick from here in Milwaukee and his partner Josh Krisnick out of the Twin Cities, they bought the property just a few years ago. Got it mostly because Tony runs Interstate Parking. He wanted the parking structure, which produces a lot of cash flow. And that alone for him made it a good investment. So then the question is, well, what do you do with this dying, dormant downtown mall? What they came up with was taking the Plankinton Arcade portion. That's the historic building, the ones that's in between Plankinton and 2nd Street. And if you've been over there lately, you've noticed on the second floor, some apartments are starting to emerge. They took all that empty space and they're converting into 52 high-end apartments. I think they first start leasing this month in January. Then with the what's sometimes called the new arcade, which is the newer portion that's next to what used to be Boston's store, they just announced that the first floor is going to be converted into 3rd Street Market Hall. That's going to be a food hall, not a food court. We're not going to have Rocky Rococo's and Cinnabon. It's going to be a food hall, so they're going to have about 20 local vendors with made-for-scratch meals. It's like DeKalb Hall in Brooklyn or Italy, I think it's called, in Chicago, if you're familiar with those places. And then on the 2nd and 3rd floors, they're going to have offices. And when they announced the food hall, they also announced they've gotten an anchor tenant for the office space. A company called Grafe, which is a planning, engineering, and design firm, is going to move into some of the space that right now is being renovated on the 3rd floor. So two really big steps forward for what's now being called the Avenue. And that's all happening in 2019. Food hall should open by fall of 2019. The offices will be done by the end of the year with Grafe, and presumably by then we'll probably have more office tenants announced as well.
All right, so not too far away, we're looking at another big project that's really transforming that area. The MSO is moving into the Grand Theater.
Yeah.
As someone who's not from Milwaukee originally, what is that space? What was it before?
Well, originally it was the Warner Grand Theater. It opened in the 1930s. It was one of these beautiful, classic, old, they sometimes called them movie palaces that you had in larger downtown cities like Milwaukee. It eventually became owned by Marcus, the dominant theater circuit in our area, and Marcus operated it until 1995, and then it closed. And it remained closed. Nothing else happened there. There's also an office building that's built into that same property. Those offices pretty much went vacant within a few years after the theater closed. They were already losing tenants, obsolete office space. So that's a very large property that sits right in the middle of West Wisconsin Avenue that's been dormant for 20-plus years, basically, right? And as you can imagine, when you get a property of that size that stays vacant for that long, it affects more than just the property itself. It kind of casts a pall over the whole area. Investors stay away. Developers stay away. So to get that being reused, redeveloped is really a big step forward for West Wisconsin Avenue in general. You combine that with what's happening with the Avenue, what we used to call Grand Avenue Mall, and that's finally starting to bring West Wisconsin Avenue up to the level that much of the rest of the downtown has been in the last few years. It's really going to have a big impact. I think in some ways, maybe even a bigger impact than the Avenue, just by virtue of replacing a large dormant property with lots of life, lots of activity.
So what is the plan there? I know the MSO is planning to move into the theater space. Are they also going to be in the office space?
Yeah, a portion of the office space they'll use for their administrative offices, which are currently located at a not at the Marcus Center where they currently perform, but another downtown location. So they'll have their administrative offices there. They'll have some other facilities there, like their music library, things like that. Some of that space will be set aside for future uses. There's been talk of having this cool kind of penthouse-style jazz club at the very top. I mean, who knows if that happens. But yeah, both buildings will be redeveloped. The former Kaiku restaurant has been demolished. That was just down from the Grand Theater at the corner. And that's where you're going to have sort of this beautiful glassy kind of annex built, sort of the grand entrance into the concert hall, into the performance center. And all that construction is happening in 2019. It's not going to open until symphony season that begins in 2020. But one thing we can look forward to in this year is at some point they have to move the wall that's along North 2nd Street into the middle of North 2nd Street. They have to literally take this wall, detach it, and move it in order to extend out the building, the theater building, enough to accommodate a stage big enough for the orchestra. And that's going to be kind of interesting because that wall is going to move probably – obviously very, very slowly and very carefully. And that'll be something to watch for next year, or yeah. I should say this year, 2019.
Bring your popcorn.
Yeah, right. For all you wall nerds out there.
So moving just up the street from us here, there's a rather large project that's been going on for a bit now. People who work downtown, we've been noticing it, the BMO Tower.
Yeah, the BMO Tower.
How big is that going to be?
It's going to end up being one of the taller office buildings in downtown Milwaukee, 25 stories. Right now, everyone in Chicago is laughing at us because 25 stories. But okay, it's Milwaukee. 25 stories is a thing. And that started construction in early 2018. It's now really kind of ramped up. You can see it rising out of the ground. It'll be done by the end of 2019. The anchor tenant, as you would expect, will be BMO Harris Bank. They're moving from their older building next door. They're going to take the main amount of space. Michael Best and Friedrich, which is a law firm that's at the 100 East office tower, just down the block, basically, at Water in Wisconsin, they'll move in. And between those two tenants, you'll have roughly half the space accounted for. And then, of course, the developer, Ergens, and their leasing agent are out talking to other tenants, and we'll probably see some tenant announcements in 2018 of other businesses going into that space.
What are the plans for their old space?
Yeah, their old space. Ergens, the development firm led by Mark Ergens, they're buying that building as well, or have bought it already, I believe. And once BMO Harris moves to the new BMO Tower, Ergens is going to redevelop the old building. And they've already talked about probably doing something other than just office space there because they view it as something that would be have a better use by adapting it to perhaps apartments, a hotel, maybe both. They've tossed around some conceptual ideas. I'm sure we'll be learning more about that, perhaps not in 2019, but probably in 2020 as they go forward on that project. And yeah, between those two developments, that's quite a big investment for downtown.
Yeah, and it's a big chunk of Water Street right there.
Right. Yeah, and of course, Water in Wisconsin, which is just a block away where we're currently doing this interview, is sort of considered the main corner, the epicenter of downtown development.
Yeah. So looking at another project, it is downtown. It's a little east of downtown almost, right on the waterfront, the Couture.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't speak French. But at any rate, yeah. The 44-story, 300-plus high-end apartment development that presumably has been pursued since the Eisenhower administration hasn't been quite that long. It's been a few years. And has taken a big step forward in its financing. In early November, the Department of Housing and Urban Development announced that that agency had invited, that's the term they use, the developer, Rick Barrett, Barrett Low Visionary Development, to apply for what HUD calls a firm commitment for a loan guarantee. What that means in English is the Couture has basically passed through HUD's underwriting process. In other words, HUD's people who do the loan guarantees have reviewed it and have essentially said, we think this is a risk worth taking to guarantee the main loan for this. They now need Barrett Low Visionary Development to come back with an application for that firm commitment. The firm is working on that right now as we speak. And once they get that into HUD, assuming they meet HUD's conditions, HUD will probably announce approval within about 60 days or so. So if all that goes according to plan, you would probably see construction on the Couture begin in spring of 2019. That's going to take about 2 years to build, but that will be a huge addition to downtown's lakefront.
It is. It sounds like it's going to be a huge space. As I recall, there was talk of the streetcar running through the Couture.
Yeah.
There was talk of kind of a bridge over into like the lakefront area. What is the timeline for that? Do we even have that yet?
Well, the city is helping finance those portions. Those are all public, basically public improvements. The skywalks would be accessible to the public. The transit concourse would accommodate buses, but it would also accommodate the new hop because the city's already laid the tracks for the hop to go from its main route all the way down to the Couture at the lakefront. They can complete those tracks, which will connect Clybourne and Michigan, by building this turnaround through a transit concourse. So the city is financing all that. They're doing it with new property tax revenue generated by the Couture, as well as a newer office building right next to the Couture, which is called 833 East. And yeah, when construction begins on the Couture, the transit concourse will be one of the first things getting built. And that needs to happen by a certain deadline. There is a clock ticking that some city officials have been concerned about, because this gets a little complicated. The Federal Transit Administration basically provided a grant several years ago, 20-plus years ago, to build this ridiculous, pointless bus facility on the site where the Couture is now going to get built. When that was then sold to the developer at a below-market cost to help the developer, again, Rick Barrett, finance the project, the Federal Transit Administration essentially said, we won't require you to pay back our proceeds of that sale, because it was sold at less than market value, as long as the site gets reused for a transit purpose, that being the transit concourse. But there's a deadline. You have to have the transit concourse up and running by X date. I want to say off the top of my head, it's sometime in late 2020. So the city really wants to get that transit, and the county really wants to get that transit concourse up and running. So that'll be one of the first things. As it comes out of the ground, that's going to be one thing that's probably going to get built and hopefully operating perhaps even before the entire building is finished.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Looking at another project that's transforming not so much the lakefront, but the waterfront.
Right.
The Harbor District. Mm-hmm. Now, I've been hearing about this for a while now. What's there now, and what are they hoping to do with it?
Well, the Harbor District, first of all, is roughly a big chunk of probably what most people think of as being Walker's Point. So think of it running from, say, the Third Ward down to Bayview, roughly from First Street to the harbor, to the waterfront. That area, it's really interesting. If you're on First Street, you see a lot of new restaurants, you see new apartments. As soon as you go east of First Street, you only have to go about a block or so, and you are in a very different world, very industrial, a lot of empty lots, a lot of buildings that are no longer being used or are being underused for storage or other purposes. So the idea was to try and bring that up to a higher level of use. The Common Council and Mayor Tom Barrett in February of 2018 approved a water and land use plan for this area that envisioned new housing, new offices, other purposes to replace these obsolete uses. And as it happens, we've now got two major projects that are going to be moving forward in 2019. The biggest is the Komatsu Mining Corporation corporate campus. Komatsu announced in September that they're planning to move their manufacturing operations from West Milwaukee at National Miller Parkway, and their corporate offices from Milwaukee's west side, which is at the Honey Creek Corporate Center, that's at roughly South 84th and I-94, into this new corporate campus on roughly 50-plus acres where East Greenfield Avenue essentially ends at the harbor. So this is a piece of land that the city owns. It was part of the Harbor Commission's property, the Port of Milwaukee. And then the larger chunk is the old Milwaukee Solvay Coke Company. Not Coke like you drink, but Coke like when you used to take coal and refined it to create a product that you would sometimes use to create gas or use at the steel refining.
Petroleum coke?
Yeah, very, very old industrial use that basically has been dormant since like 1980 or the early 80s. That land is now being cleaned up. Fortunately, We Energies stepped up and took responsibility, and they're doing the environmental cleanup right now. And once it's cleaned up, Komatsu buys that land from We Energies. They buy the land from the city, and they build offices and a manufacturing facility, a training facility, even a museum, I guess a museum of surface mining equipment or whatever. So there's that project. And then the other project, smaller but still significant, is one that's called River One. And River One is being led by Michaels Corporation. They're based here in Wisconsin in Brownsville. But they have a lot of operations here in southeastern Wisconsin. And while this won't be their headquarters, it will be a very large office building that they will anchor for their southeastern Wisconsin operations. Michaels Corporation basically is a contractor that does a lot of underground infrastructure work. So think sewer, water, stuff like that. And they're going to have the office building there that they'll anchor in the first phase, but they also hope to build additional office buildings. They hope to build an apartment building. They hope to build a hotel. And this is on land that would be basically at Beecher and First Street on the Kinnickinnick River. Your more depraved listeners would remember the old Horny Goat Hideaway Tavern being there. Thank God it's gone. It's been demolished, carted away, and will never be spoken of again. But yeah, that's where River One is going.
It's funny. I was just talking with people who were really lamenting the loss of that. I don't know anything about it.
Yeah. Yeah. I think the name says it all.
Fair enough.
Yeah.
Tom, thank you so much for joining us here on
thank
Lake
you,
Effect.
Joy.
Tom Dakin is a reporter who covers commercial real estate and development for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. He spoke with Joy Powers. You can find a list of the developments they discussed at WUWM.com.
Coming up next on the program, we'll speak with a writer who helped translate an oral history of basketball to the printed page. Lake Effect Weekend returns with that in a moment on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. We're back with more of Lake Effect Weekend. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. For a basketball team that's won only one world championship, the Milwaukee Bucks have featured quite a few legends of the game on the court. Players like Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, Oscar Robertson, Moses Malone, and Ray Allen.
While the current generation of basketball fans might know those names, they're much more familiar with the dazzling work of current Bucks like Giannis Antetokounmpo and Chris Middleton. But a recent long-form ESPN documentary told the story of basketball in this country through an oral history from its players.
And a recent book takes the conversation a step further. Rafe Bartholomew is co-author of the book Basketball, A Love Story, the companion to the film, and he joined us by phone to share more. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Mitch.
So the thing, or one of the things that really hit me about so many of the stories these basketball people tell of, you know, how they fell for basketball is how many of them are solitary stories. You know, the player who would go out in their driveway or down to the playground or to the, you know, the basket that was nailed to a telephone pole and just play hour after hour after hour. Is there something in the experience of falling for this sport that makes it unique versus the other popular sports in the country, do you think?
I think so, and that solitary nature you're bringing up has to do with it's a sport that you can play and practice alone. It's very difficult to go play catch in a meaningful way as a baseball player on your own. I guess, you know, you could throw against the wall. When I played baseball growing up, I even built like a thing to throw strikes into when I was trying to pitch. So you could do it a little bit, but it's just not the same as basketball. You can't have the experience that people like Bill Bradley and Bernard King are talking about when they're out on the court at night or in the gym alone, working on every shot, perfecting every move. Steve Nash talking about the way just imagining his way through a workout kind of opened up his mind to the realm of possibility of the sport. So that's something that I think is unique to basketball.
What was the moment for you when you connected with it?
Oh, for me, it was very early. My father had played basketball in Ohio and played when he moved to New York, and I grew up in New York at the time when basketball was very hot, the Stephon Marbury high school era, and I started playing at like age 8 or 9. It really became the sport I loved when I got picked to join a traveling team for our rec center, which was sort of like the elite group of 12-year-olds. And one of my teammates was Smush Parker, who went on to play with the Los Angeles Lakers for a couple of years. And feeling, and some of the players expressed this, when you suddenly feel like you're so good at something, and in my case, it wasn't true. I was just playing with people who were that good with them. But when you all of a sudden feel that you are that good at something, you just want to keep doing it. You want to keep getting better and better and better at it. And then it became part of my blood in a way that I don't feel comfortable if I don't kind of get shots up every couple of days at least.
So this project had to be a little tricky for you. You and Jackie McMullen came into the book part of it after the interviews had already been conducted, right?
Yes. I've worked on shorter oral history projects when I was working at the website Grantland, and it is a much different process when you are there from the beginning, and the original intent of the project is for it to be published as a book or as an article in words, because your interviews then can shape this narrative. You ask a few leading questions kind of to provide transitions when you know you'll need them on the page. And Jackie and I did not always have the luxury of those kind of moments, because these interviews were conducted with the original intent of being part of Basketball Love Story, the ESPN film. So we did have to sort of get creative and find the transitions where we could. And it also, I think, limited what we were going to cover, right? We could only work with the words on the page. We couldn't really, in some cases, because Jackie is such a respected and longtime, I mean, she is a member of the Basketball Hall of Fame media wing, she was able to go back and conduct a little bit of follow-ups or add players who weren't in the film to the books. But for the most part, we had these transcripts, which were rich and plentiful to, you know, our wildest dreams. But still, you couldn't change what was there. And in some cases, when something was missing or there was something that I wished had been in there that wasn't, there's nothing I can do. I can't call Oscar Robertson and say, "Hey, Oscar, how do we? I was wondering if we could just add a little bit of this in there." That opportunity didn't exist. And I bring up Oscar Robertson because there's one moment I had read about and I had always wanted to ask him about and kind of hoped to find in his interview. He did 5 hours for the film, but unfortunately it did not come up. And that was this time during the Knicks' first championship season, when they started the year, this would, I guess, 1969-70, they started the year on this, at the time, record-setting winning streak. It was 23 games. And one of the later games in that streak was at Cincinnati against the Royals, where Oscar Robertson was the star, and Bob Cousy had just been hired as the coach. And there was a moment where, near the end of the game, where Cousy, who was not a player coach, but decided to dress and sub himself into the game to throw an inbounds pass at the very end of the game. And I, from what I had read about it, Oscar Robertson was not pleased with that. He was like, "Get out of here. This is you are retired, sir." So I've always wanted to hear Oscar Robertson explain that a little bit, but it did not come up in the interviews. But so, yeah, we it feels strange to say that we were limited by thousands of pages of interviews in depth with many of the greatest players and coaches and figures in sports history. But still, there were things that just weren't there, and we couldn't get to them.
Right. It's like the drinking from the fire hose metaphor, where you've got all this stuff, but it's still, it's only the water coming out of that one fire hose.
Exactly.
Well, and you mentioned that story of Oscar Robertson, and it reminds me, or I guess it reminds me of this question. You know, we're talking at a time when basketball is again at or near the top of the heap. Did you feel any special responsibility in turning this into a book to the stories of basketball from the days when the like the NBA Finals were on tape delay? I mean, the time before everybody had access to all the information they wanted at all times.
I think I feel a little bit of that mission, and part of it is practical. While there is a lot of really strong material from the 90s, 2000s, this decade, today's players are very well represented. You have Anthony Davis, Steph Curry, Kevin Durant are all part of the film and the book, and many others. They still, one, because they're active players and kind of have to be a little bit more protective about what they say in their interviews, and two, because their time is a little more precious, so they don't sit for 5 hours for an interview. So we just had more to work with. So there's with the older players in those generations, so there's a little bit of that pragmatism side of how they come to be such a big part of the book and the film. But I think there also definitely is that sense that these are the stories that I didn't know as well. These are the stories that I didn't grow up with and hear a million times on sports TV and already read 16 books about. The stories from those older eras, from when finals were on tape delay, and sort of the travel stories of the old Celtics and teams when they had to play in Fort Wayne, Indiana, they'd get dropped off by, they'd like hitch a ride on a train in the middle of the night and get dropped off and then find some college kids to pick them up hitchhiking into town. Those sort of stories are the ones that, to me, really make projects like this special, because it opens up a whole world that existed, but we just didn't know all the details about. We still don't know all the details about, but adding to that knowledge, I think, is really important.
There is something to be said for having these guys talk about stuff that happened 40 and 50 and even 60 years ago, and being able to add the perspective that they, you know, like they're looking back on this, whereas, you know, you talk to LeBron James now or Steph Curry now or whatever, and the stuff has just happened. They don't have that, you know, way to evaluate it in the context of everything else that's happened.
Absolutely. And those stars have to be protective of their images, their brands, how telling the full story of things could then turn into a huge news event that disrupts their entire season. They have to be a little more cautious than someone who's retired and can really just lay it all out there.
I want to ask you about a couple of games that you cover in depth in this book that maybe, you know, fans today in the Giannis or Steph Curry era might not necessarily be familiar with. There was this one game in 1968 between UCLA and the University of Houston, and it was a regular season game. This wasn't part of the tournament. Why was this game at the Astrodome such a big deal?
Well, it was like the clash of the Titans. It was Lew Alcindor, who before he changed his name to Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, on that epic UCLA winning streak. They were deemed unbeatable, and in fact, they were unbeatable for many years, winning championship after championship with John Wooden. And this version of it with Kareem was perhaps maybe the best, but definitely, I would say, sort of the one that people believed was the most untouchable, probably because of Alcindor. And they were playing Elvin Hayes, finally another big man with a chance to sort of compete on that level. And then the fact that they put it in this enormous arena with, I don't have the actual attendance number at my fingertips.
It was like 57,000 or something.
So it was a record setting, a number of people jammed into one place for a basketball game, and they said it looked ridiculous that they moved. It was just a tiny court in the middle of a football field, and people looking at the ants running around at the bottom. But just the magnitude of the event was unprecedented in basketball history. And it turned out that Houston won. They beat UCLA, and the stuff in the book is great, going back and forth between Elvin Hayes and the players on UCLA who say that Alcindor was injured. He had an eye injury. He couldn't. He just wasn't 100% of Kareem there that night. And Elvin Hayes saying, like, look, well, we still won that game, and you can never take that back. That was the biggest game, even though Houston went on to lose to UCLA in the Final Four that year and lose badly. Even though they lost that game, Elvin Hayes kind of treats that game in the regular season as the most important game of the year because of the magnitude of it and because of what it meant. Finally, someone had taken UCLA down.
Right. For a guy who had plenty of really star moments in his basketball career, you get the sense that he still looks back at that as this shining moment in his basketball history.
Right. He's sort of like, you can never take that away from me, Kareem. In the way that, and he said that him and Kareem, after that, were always icy to each other on the court, even in the NBA, even though they had no, as professionals, they didn't have. It became the Lakers and the Celtics and, you know, Kareem versus Mikhail and Parrish. You didn't really see Elvin Hayes in that mix against them, but I guess there was still that college passion still burned in them.
Yeah. The other game that it's actually still a matter of contention was the gold medal game in the 72 Olympics. And this is a result that people who played in the game still dispute.
And it's been interesting. I've a lot of younger basketball media people who I follow have looked back on it, and there's a little bit of revisionism saying that maybe it wasn't quite the screw job that the U.S. players believe it was when, you know, they lost. It was the first U.S. men's Olympic loss in basketball in 1972 to the Soviet Union, the gold medal game. They replayed the last 3 seconds of the game three times, basically, until the Soviet team won. And there's a lot of questions about, was there a mechanical glitch on the shot clock? When were the Soviet team allowed to take a timeout, and when was it granted, and why they kept getting chances to replay it? Obviously, Doug Collins and Mike Bantam and the players involved in the 72 game felt strongly enough they made the very conscious decision, right, never to accept those silver medals. They did not appear on the podium at the games, and despite certain overtures by Tom McMillan, the one of the players on the team who went on to have be a congressman in Maryland for a little while, he made overtures about, well, maybe we can accept dual golds with the Russians and then give something to charities. We'll make something positive out of it. But there are guys from that team like Kevin Joyce, who are just, they have it in their wills that no one in their family can ever accept that silver medal under any circumstance, and the entire team would never do it unless it were unanimous. And it remains probably the most controversial game in basketball history, right?
Yeah, absolutely. So the idea here is that it is in basketball a love story, but you know, you think of that story from 72 and, you know, many others in this book, and it could easily be, you know, basketball a love hate story. Did you have to weigh, you know, the idea of documenting love for the game against, you know, like keeping from over romanticizing it, you know, having people just look back with these, you know, rose colored lenses?
Well, I think you hit on it when you say the love hate and the same passion that inspires all the love that the people in the book express for the game and probably a lot of the people who end up reading the book and watching the film feel for it themselves. That love obviously comes from a same strength of emotion that can become extremely painful. And I think neither the book nor the film shies away from many of the ways that it was that, whether you're talking about the NBA's early racial quotas and the chapter in the book on some of the really awful discrimination that black players in the 50s and 60s faced just trying to play the game, whether you're talking about Oscar Robertson's story of winning the Indiana high school basketball state championship with his all black team and them not being given the same parade that had been traditionally given to all the other teams that won the state championship in downtown Indianapolis. Instead, they were bussed out to a field outside of town and just left there because they wouldn't give a parade to an all-black team at the time. Whether it's John Thompson, the former Georgetown coach and Celtics player, who's talking about how in a really, I guess it's a difficult observation, but a very true one and something that rings true today. He says that one of the biggest, or to him, the biggest myth in America is the idea of equality. He says no man who had a leg up on someone else wants that person to ever become equal to them. They want to, there's this human instinct to be above someone, and various ways that was expressed in basketball. And the stories of Connie Hawkins and Roger Brown being blacklisted in the gambling scandals of the 60s and how their careers were unfairly ruined. And maybe they got some of them back, you know, in the ABA and the NBA eventually, but their primes were taken from them and they were never the same people. So there is all that pain and hate. And I think the way you can still look at it as basketball, the love story, is everyone in the book faced some sort of obstacle to achieve what they did in the game. Often really, really overwhelming odds, whether it be growing up in difficult situations in urban areas, in rural poverty, in whatever, and just playing the game against all the things holding them back. It was a lot of what brought them to the levels they achieved. So in these cases, it does end up being more positive than not, a net positive, because basketball was the thing that allowed people to overcome and that passion, even when there were moments, really, really terrible moments involved. And, you know, the pain and the hatred side of that passion was there. The love kind of won out in the end.
Well, and it seems like even at the end of this process for you, after going through, you know, all of these, you know, hundreds of hours of interview transcripts, you still need your fix.
Absolutely. 100%. I think and you talked about these interview transcripts. I reread them. They are, even if they're raw and all over the place, being able to look at what feels like a version of the Dead Sea Scrolls of basketball, all this accumulated wisdom from generations of men and women and young and old who played the game. It's powerful stuff to see those raw words on the page.
Well, Rafe Bartholomew, it's powerful stuff to read on the even the non-raw words. Really enjoyable stuff.
Great. Thank you. Thanks.
Rafe Bartholomew is one of the co-authors of the recent book, Basketball, A Love Story. It's the companion to the ESPN documentary film, and you can find more about it at WUWM.com.
We will take one last break and then return with our storytelling series, Exfabula. Lake Effect Weekend continues in a moment on Milwaukee's NPR.
3, 2, 1.
Welcome to Exfabula!
True personal stories.
Exfabula is a Milwaukee nonprofit committed to strengthening community bonds through the art of storytelling.
And welcome back to another edition of Exfabula Radio on Lake Effect Weekend. I'm Rachel Owens, joined once again by Leah Delaney, Exfabula co-founder. Welcome back.
Thanks so much for having me.
And the theme for this week is...
And the beat goes on. So I know that everybody is starting to take a look back at 2018 and to see what worked and what didn't. And I place very special import on this, and I always have. It's about renewal and such, and, you know, what worked in 2018 and what didn't, and what kind of decisions did I make, and what were the things that happened around me that I had no control over, and how did I handle those? Like I said, it's been bittersweet. I've lost a handful of friends, two from cancer and one who battled with depression. And it's really, really put a lot of import on family and friends and how it all really comes back to that. Mm-hmm. And how much you share with them and how connected you are with them. So we are going to start out today's show with a story I actually told. And we had an event, Exfabula did, celebrating our 10th season. and a bunch of us, the co-founders, got up and got to say our say. And since I've been so connected with radio over the past 10 years, I thought I would say a little something about Bruce Winter, who we all are dearly missing, especially at this time of the year. Mm-hmm. So let's listen to, sounds weird, but Leah Delaney's story, where I'm just saying a little note about our pal Bruce Winter.
I love, love radio. I always have loved radio, even as a child. And then growing up with Casey Kasem's America's Top 40, of which I still listen to in syndication today because it is the only place you're going to be able to hear a Dolly Parton B-side straight next to, like, the Shaft theme song and just be blown away. Like, this was a part of time at some point in our lives. And with that being said, you know, thank you, Ryan. I'm glad that we had that introduction. He was able to sort of intro Xfabula into the radio listening audience. And we worked with them for a while. And then Bruce Winter from WWM shortly after had tapped us and said, hey, what are you guys doing over there? You want to come speak to us for a while? Such a great opportunity to get on Milwaukee NPR. It was it was kind of a little tenuous in the beginning because what we did with WMSC is we had a script, and it was a half an hour script of a curated radio show where we would find stories from different events, put them together, and stick another umbrella of a theme over it. But it's all scripted. So at WMSC, I would just read the script, and it was very lovely, and it sounded like an elevator voice and such, and please go to your right, go to your left. Well, we took that business model, and we took it to WWM. So we took our hour-long script, and we marched right into the studio and gave it to Bruce, and I had my script, and I was ready for it, and he looked at it, and he had that what stinks look, like his, you know, kind of like, what is this? Like, what is this robot work that we're doing here? But we read the script. He had his part. I had mine. And we started what was a one-hour show. And that was wonderful in a lot of ways, but I was really nervous. And it's funny that when we dropped the script and we just went, even though they're pre-recorded, we kind of went live in a sense where we were able to bounce off of each other. And it was great. I loved it. I still love it. But I go park somewhere downtown in the middle of, like, lunchtime hour, try to find a parking space, you know, weasel my way in, take that elevator at the Chase Building on Water in Wisconsin, up to the 7th floor, ding, elevator doors open, there's an open lobby, and to your right, always east, the glass doors to WWM were there, and 9 times out of 10, Bruce was sitting there tinking around on his phone, and then he'd see me. And then he would, like, do this majestic pirouette to the door to let me in, or he would start genuflecting. I mean, we were off to the races immediately because it was fun time USA with him always. I remember one time when I had a really hard time parking, but I made it happen. And I came up to the elevator, ding, doors open. I look over, and him and one of his coworkers are, like, kind of like talking, and they're pointing downstairs, and then they turn around, they see me, they open up the door, and he's like, oh my God, you should have saw this person park just now. And I was like, oh, were they a total dupe? And he's like, you betcha. And I was like, that was me. I completely, like, did love touches, like, on both bumpers, because I was late and I needed to get in there. But so much levity with him, and so much corniness, too. Like, quoting Airplane to Ernie Kovacs, to having all these weird conversations about music. And then he would press record. And it would start out, and here's another Xfabula radio hour. My name is Bruce Winter, and alongside me is co-founder Leah Delaney. You brought some stories, and so on. We always knew he was sick. Xfabula knew. And we kept it a secret. So there were times when I would get an email saying from Rachel Owens that she was going to do the recording that week. And there was always a moment of panic because over the course of the past 9 years, it's like, what happened? And so I would get there, have a conversation with her, hug her, and say, okay, is Bruce okay? What's going on? But he always came back without question. And not only that, but God dang it, he's so freaking funny. And so dark but funny and irreverent, just nonstop with him, just wonderful. On Wednesday, I found out last week that he passed away. On Thursday, I had to go in and do my normal recording, so I did. And, you know, I heard on Wednesday that he passed away, and I thought, oh, this is horrible, logically, but it didn't really sink in. But I parked again over on Water in Wisconsin, and I took that elevator up, and all of a sudden it started digging further and further up, and I thought, I don't even want this elevator to stop. I started getting a little panicky, and sure enough, it dinged, the doors opened, and I walked out and fell out into the lobby, and I just lost it. And I looked over, and he wasn't on that couch, and he wasn't pirouetting at me. He wasn't genuflecting. I was like, that's it. It's never going to happen again. And it struck me like never before, like a ton of bricks, you know? And that's what happens with loss. For the first time you're in a recognizable spot with somebody and they're not there anymore, boom. So this whole thing with storytelling and such, it's amazing how, like, I think that over the course of the past, like, 10 seasons, we've come to learn so much as an organization. Listening to you guys tell us your stories, seeing what works, what doesn't, knowing that storytelling is so wonderful for activism. It's an art. But when somebody passes away, those stories that you know that that person is not going to be able to contribute to more stories in their life, is so it's monumental. And there's a moment of desperation I think we all feel when somebody passes away that we just want to keep hearing more because we need to understand all facets of that person. And that's kind of like where I'm at right now with this. He was a good friend to us. He's community-minded. He was a loving, prickly pear of a human being. And I'm going to miss him dearly. And I just wanted to throw it up there and just say thank you, Bruce, for everything. You've been wonderful. Thank you.
And that was a story I told, basically saying goodbye to Bruce and thanking him for his time that he gave us. I can't say this enough about what I ended on in that story, which was it's so important to reach out to people. And it's so important to listen to people, actively listening to their stories and their thoughts and such. And sometimes we feel like we just don't have any time for anybody except for ourselves. And we really have to take a beat and remember what this is all about. Mm. I know I don't want to sound like a new age hippie, but it's so true.
And yeah, that it was a beautiful story. So thank you for sharing that with us. Yeah. I feel the same way. This year for me personally has been similar, where you just feel like, man, there is no time to waste. You have to appreciate those around us. And some of my own fond memories of Bruce are us just sitting by the window, as you described him, when you arrived that day, looking out the window by our offices and looking into the Milwaukee River and just kind of chatting about some random things. But then you find yourself bonding over those moments, and it can take just a few minutes. But boy, yeah, storytelling is something that obviously he took very seriously. And again, we're very grateful that we have this connection now because of him and because of you and X-Fabula.
So. Oh, man. Yeah. Truer words. Seriously. Thank you, Rachel. We still have another story we'd like to share. This second teller's name is Mark Weinberg, and he told the story about his loss, and basically lost and found, I want to call it. Here's his Generation Story Slam story.
I had no intention of telling a story today, but I had lunch with my 92-year-old mother and realized that sooner or later we become just stories. So I decided to start early. As I said, my mother's 92. My father was 53 when he died of pancreatic cancer. We were in the hospital room with him, and he hadn't moved much for a day, and he summoned all his strength, and he motioned to my mother to come over, and she bent down, and he whispered in her ear, "I love you." And then he slipped into a coma. And the next day, his breathing slowly became more labored. The distance between breaths increased. And once we thought he was gone, but he took a big deep breath, and he reached out his hand sort of like to say, Oh, is that what it's about? And he smiled, and then he was gone. It wasn't my father in the bed anymore. Jump forward 2 years later, I'm in the hospital again. I am next to my then wife, waiting for the birth of my daughter. I was raised in the Jewish tradition. And in that tradition, when a child is born, they're named after the most recent person who passed away in the family. Well, my wife was from a different tradition. We decided not to do that. Not on a first name, on a middle name. And so we waited for a very short time, and my daughter rushed into the world, and Rachel was born. But because she rushed so quickly, she appeared a little bit drowsy, and it took her a while to breathe. And so the distance between her breaths was very great, but it got shorter and shorter and shorter until she was breathing normally. And the doctor handed her to me, and I looked down, and my father looked back at me. Not somebody that looked like my father, not the face of someone related to my father, but my father. I looked at her mother, she looked at Rachel, my daughter, and saw the same thing. And when I looked back at Rachel, my father was gone, and she was there. My father's name was Norman, and he was the glue that held our family together. He was surrogate father for everyone. He was caregiver. He was the person you went to, and he taught us all a lot. My daughter shares a lot with my father. She's been a guide for children, a teacher, a school administrator. Now she administers a project that helps people deal with the problems related to Alzheimer's. My father was Norman. My daughter's middle name is Nera. Ner is the Hebrew word for candle or light. My father was a light in this world. My daughter is a light in this world. And I'm lucky enough to live between those two generations, and I try to duplicate what they do in spirit every day. Thank you.
And that was Mark Weinberg with his story that he told at our Generation Story Slam.
Wow, that's very powerful.
Mm-hmm. Definitely gives you goosebumps.
Yeah. Wow. So we're saying thank you and goodbye to 2018 as well, it feels like. That means we're also starting a new year, though.
So if anyone's interested in partaking, maybe for the first time, maybe that's your New Year's resolution, you are actually going to tell a story at one of our slams in which we're there for you, Milwaukee, with open arms. So go to xfabula.org for all story-related news and activities in Milwaukee.
Time to reflect and to look forward to a new year. So Thank you for making our 2018 a little bit sweeter. And thank you again for coming in. We look forward to 2019 with X Fabula.
Happy New Year, Rachel.
X Fabula is a regular feature on Lake Effect Weekend, and it does wrap up another edition of the show. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tighe. Thank you for making us a part of your afternoon. Lake Effect Weekend airs every Saturday and Sunday from 3 to 4 on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
Stay tuned now for All Things Considered. Coming up next, it's 4 o'clock.